Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Well, hello everyone. This is Anna, and along with Nick and Chris, we would like to welcome you to Audio Journal Sports Page. This is a program by, for, and about sports, activities, adventure, and information involving people with a variety of disabilities. Okay, I'm going to start off my segment here with this article I found. And it is titled, On the Slopes of Cortina, Adaptive Fashion is Quietly Redefining Performance. From seam placement to accessible zippers, the garments worn by Paralympic athletes reveal how fashion is evolving to meet complex bodies, equipment, and identities. Cortina d'Ampezzo is called the Queen of the Dolomites for good reason. Nestled high in the mountains, this shimmering alpine town provides a dramatic backdrop for an equally historic tradition. The 2026 Paralympic Winter Games. The International Competition for Athletes with Disabilities has been held for nearly 80 years, and this year marked the 50th anniversary of the Winter Edition. With 665 athletes competing across 79 events, the Paralympics place extraordinary athletic achievement on full display. Behind every potential medal lies an arsenal of specialized equipment, and attire is among the most crucial components. As the highest levels of sports, clothing must perform as precisely as the athlete wearing it. To understand how adaptive clothing has reached this moment, it helps to briefly look back. Recognizable elements of adaptive fashion date back as far as the late 19th century. With the innovation of the snap and zipper, Helen Cookman and Virginia Pope helped lead what is often called the first wave of adaptive fashion in the 1950s, when the return of disabled veterans from World War II created new demand for clothing that supported independence. Though the industry drifted away from style in later decades, brands such as Is Adaptive and Bez Granite's Couture reintroduced a design-forward approach in the early 2000s. Today, the scale of conversation is undeniable. According to the World Health Organization, roughly 1.3 billion people worldwide live with disabilities, representing a global market with more than $13 trillion in annual disposable income. The adaptive clothing sector alone is projected to surpass $30 billion by 2034. But statistics only tell part of the story. The Paralympics offer a rare lens into clothing under pressure, a stage where functionality and aesthetics must answer to an unusually complex set of demands. Athletes must compete at the highest level while navigating prosthetics, wheelchair, and other mobility aids. At the same time, they maintain the same relationship with clothing as anyone else, the desire to feel comfortable, confident, and recognizable as themselves. To make sense of how fashion responds to those demands, it helps to look through the eyes of a designer. Elisabetta Venturelli, who grew up around Cortina, trained in Milan, and now designs activewear and outerwear for global brands in New York, has spent much of her career working at the intersection of performance, tailoring, and everyday life. Watching the Paralympians compete in the mountain she once called home, she sees adaptive design not as a niche category, but as an intense expression of fashion's broader purpose. When you watch these athletes move, you realize how precise clothing has to be, Elisabetta says. Details like seam placement, the weight of a fabric, or how easily a zipper can be reached suddenly become critical. But those insights don't only apply to adaptive clothing. They can improve design for everyone. On the slopes, athletes themselves are the best judges of what works. I'm usually more of a functionality type of person, confesses American para-alpine skiing phenom Blake Eaton. I try to get it done using whatever works for me is the easiest, but I usually don't worry about how I look. It's more like how I feel. For Eaton, certain details can make all the difference. With pants, I like ties or anything with elastic waistbands. Being able to pull them up and down in a chair is important. Snow pants are usually bibs because otherwise, when I get out of my monoski, they fall down. And with jackets, I just want something not too baggy or long. Skiers break zippers often, so I prefer something strong and easy to grab. Mobility aids fundamentally change how clothing behaves. A lot of our clothes are good, but there's a lot of white outfits, which is kind of frustrating for the Paralympics side, admits Eaton's teammate Robert Engel. Our wheelchairs pick up dirt constantly, especially when it's snowing. Our opening ceremony outfits were awesome, but they were long fleece gowns, and it's hard to wear something like that in a wheelchair. Jackets fall over the sides and pick up the grime. In many cases, clothing must be designed in relation to the wheelchair itself. The materials get beat up and wear down, Engel says. For most wheelchair users, you pick clothes that basically fit you. But if something hangs over the sides, it rubs against the wheels. Sometimes the wheelchair is actually more important than the clothing. Designers, Elisabetta notes, have to account for these altered relationships between body, garment, and equipment. If someone is sitting most of the time, proportions change, she explained. A coat behaves differently. Pants fit differently. The waist needs more stretch. But that doesn't mean style disappears. It means the design process has to become more attentive. Some athletes are already working with brands to push those ideas forward. I really like to look good when I'm outside of skiing, proclaims Norwegian para-alpine skier and six-time Paralympic gold medalist Jesper Petersen, who collaborates with Healy Hansen on equipment and apparel. But when you're sitting in a wheelchair, some cuts simply don't work. Long coats behave differently, so we often adjust pieces to fit better. Footwear presents its own challenges. These shoes are from the Olympic Village set, Engel reveals, pointing to a pair made by Nike. They added a zipper, which helps a lot. Normally, it's really difficult to get shoes on. Having fashionable shoes with hidden zippers would make a big difference. For others, the priority remains efficiency. When it comes to ski clothes and the clothes we train in, it's all about functionality, asserts Norwegian competitor Bernt Marius Rostad. Zippers that make prosthesis easier to access so you don't have to take everything off and on again. It's about using the least amount of energy on clothing. American para-alpine skier Noah Burry, who has taken a keen interest in design himself, noted how closely athletes tend to study their gear. Small adjustments, such as how sleeves move when pushing a wheelchair, where seams fall against the equipment, and how easily closures can be reached, can make a significant difference over long days on the mountain. When we met him, he was wearing convertible trouser shorts with a discrete zipper system that allowed the garment to transform full trousers into shorts. paired with a beautifully patterned prosthetic that, if anything, elevated the look, the piece illustrated how thoughtful design can quietly solve practical challenges while still allowing individuality to come through. And indeed, across conversations with athletes, one theme emerges repeatedly. Functionality does not eliminate the desire for style. Athletes speak not only about efficiency and durability, but also about how clothing looks, moves, and allows them to present themselves beyond the competition. Adaptive clothing is often framed as solving a problem, Elizabeth comments. But what the athletes remind us is that people still want to express themselves. They want clothing that reflects who they are, not just that something that works. For several of the women competing in Cortina, the conversation about clothing quickly turned as much to identity as function. American para-alpine skier Sailor O'Brien, recognizable on the slopes for her bright blue hair and glitter cheeks, described clothing as one way athletes continue to express themselves beyond competition. I want things that work, she says, but I also want to feel like myself. Other athletes pointed to another step in the injury could take. Paralympic champion Brenna Huckabee, who has collaborated with brands experimenting with adaptive design, suggested that the most meaningful progress will come when people with disabilities are involved earlier in the process. Consulting athletes or even bringing disabled designers directly into design teams can reveal insights that are difficult to anticipate from a studio. As teammate Jocelyn Hamway noted, many of the solutions athletes rely on today began as small adjustments made out of necessity. For the fashion industry, the Paralympics offer a powerful design laboratory, creating garments for bodies that interact differently with clothing exposes assumptions that mainstream fashion often ignores about proportions, movements, closure, and materials. In solving those challenges, designers often discover solutions that benefit a far broader audience. When you design for more complex needs, Elizabeth concludes, you usually end up creating clothing that is easier, more intuitive, and more comfortable for everyone. On the slopes of Cortina, the lessons of adaptive fashion are already clear. The garments that perform best are those that allow athletes to move with confidence while still expressing themselves as individuals. In that sense, adaptive design is not separate from fashion's future. It may be one of the places where that future is already taking shape. I like a story like that. Adaptive clothing is just so important. I have to say, I wear kind of an adaptive clothing, my adaptive shoes. I happen to wear an AFO, which it's kind of like a brace that goes into my shoe and comes up my leg to help my gait, my walk. And it's got to fit into a shoe. And I'll tell you, I was having such a hard time fitting this prosthetic into some shoes. It made it very difficult getting it in, getting it out. Well, a friend of mine came across this maker. It's not a commercial, just letting you know. It's called Billy, like a Billy goat. In fact, that's their little emblem. And these shoes are made for people that wear prosthetics. The sneakers I have on right now, as I'm doing this story, have shoelaces. But the trick is, there's two side zippers on the side of the shoelaces that I zip down. A flap goes up and my whole foot can come out. I can put my prosthetic in, fit my foot in, zip it up. I don't have to tie the shoelaces. They are so neat. Well, anyway, I got a pair of these. I also got kind of like a hiking boot for snow. And I also got myself a sandal kind of thing, like a river shoe, I think they call it. So I can still wear my prosthetic so I can walk properly while I'm doing activities. Well, my sneakers can be for anything, but like those river shoes, I use those for kayaking. So it helps me not just wet up a pair of sneakers. At least these are, if it's something that can actually get wet. So they're very functional. So hey, if you guys, anybody out there know somebody that wears some kind of prosthetic, needs to fit in a shoe, look up Billy. So I think it's like billy.com. But anyway, I love that story and I just want to let you guys know about it. My next article is titled Sensing Empowerment. WeWalk's Smart Cane 2.0 transforms mobility for the visually impaired. At the Consumer Electronics Show in January of 2025, the WeWalk Smart Cane 2.0 emerged as a groundbreaking tool that combines technology with user-centered design to offer independence for those with visual impairments. At CES 2025, innovation took a giant step forward for the visually impaired community with the unveiling of the WeWalk Smart Cane 2.0. This mobility aid improves safety and empowers users by integrating advanced technology through a collaboration between WeWalk and InvenSense, a TDK company. Machine Design spoke with Song Li, product marketing director, to learn about the device's technology. Key features of the smart cane include advanced sensor technology, the integration of artificial intelligence, Bluetooth connectivity, and user-centric design. The cane utilizes InvenSense's compact, low-power sensors to detect obstacles above a user's head, significantly improving navigational awareness. Li explained, adding that the AI capabilities are based on a language model akin to ChatGPT. This allows users to interact with the cane in plain language. Its Bluetooth connectivity allows the cane to link with smartphones by turn-by-turn navigation and real-time location information. Li adds that the design was developed using feedback from visually impaired users, ensuring that the cane is user-friendly and functional. Li offered some insights about the partnership, such as the collaboration between the two companies began at an embedded technology show where they recognize a shared vision for innovation. Continuous user feedback, especially from WeWalk's co-founder, Krasat Ceylan, who is visually impaired himself, played a major role in shaping the cane's design and functionality. Designed to withstand varying weather conditions, the cane has built-in safety mechanisms to communicate directions and provide haptic feedback to alert users of nearby obstacles or wrong turns. A strong flashlight feature also allows users to signal help in emergencies, increasing safety during low visibility situations. I'm telling you, technology is just amazing. Something like this can help so many people. Okay, next thing I want to talk about is, and I know I've said this before, all out adventures. With the nicer weather coming in, I think it's important for people to get out there, have a good time. This is something I take part in. So let me just tell you about All Out Adventures. Now, this is what they write. With a combination of specialized equipment and training staff, the programs are designed to encourage people of all abilities to enjoy the outdoors together. Warm season activities include kayaking, stand-up paddleboarding, pickleball, canoeing, cycling, camping, and hiking. In the winter, we did some skiing, ice skating, sled hockey, snowshoeing, indoor pickleball. But I'm telling you, all ages and abilities are welcome. They're designed and they have designed for all of us, and they have specialized people to help you. They have programs geared for people with disabilities and their families and friends. And let's see, some of the disabilities represented in our programs include age-related mobility concern, limb difference, autism, brain injury, blindness or low vision, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injuries, Parkinson's, intellectual disabilities, and psychiatric concerns. Listen, all these things are happening now. You can get out there, have fun. Let me give you the info. Please get in touch with info@alloutadventures.org, or you can call them at 413-584-2052. Let's get out there. Let's have fun. All Out Adventures. info@alloutadventures.org. I am definitely getting out there and going to have fun. All right, guys, it's all up to you. Can't wait what you got for us.
Hi, everyone. This is Nick, and I'll be reading you a few stories here for this week's edition of AJ Sports. The first story I'd like to read is from MSN.com. It's entitled Hockey Program Gives Blind and Visually Impaired Athletes a New Way to Compete. The puck rattles loudly as it glides across the ice. For players with Cincinnati Blind Hockey, that sound is everything. The growing program gives blind and visually impaired athletes the opportunity to skate, compete, and experience the game just like any other team, with a few adaptations that make it possible. I have optic nerve hypoplasia, which is basically where one of my eyes is underdeveloped, said 16-year-old player Ty Stewart. Another player, Aristotle Hahn, described his vision this way. If I look at you, your hair looks kind of one texture, and I can't really see your face except for two dark spots where eyes are. Despite limited or no vision, the athletes move confidently across the ice, passing, shooting, and even body checking. The difference is in the puck. It's larger than a standard hockey puck and contains six steel ball bearings inside. As it slides, it rattles, allowing players to track it by sound instead of sight. They don't watch the puck, they listen for it, head coach and founder Rob Wachs explained through his coaching philosophy. Once you get on my ice, you're just a hockey player. There's no disability. It's just a hockey player. The program is still in its early stages, but it's growing. Support from the Cincinnati Cyclones has helped provide ice time and opportunity, expanding access to adaptive hockey in the region. For the athletes, the impact goes far beyond the rink. Even if you're disabled, try to do something that you wouldn't expect, Hahn said. Join a team, ask coaches for accommodations, and see what you can do. Stewart said the program has given him confidence and community. Without head coach Rob or coach Renee, I wouldn't be here skating like I do. I probably wouldn't even be skating, he said. As Olympic hockey captures attention around the world, Cincinnati Blind Hockey is proving that the sport does not belong to people with perfect vision. It belongs to anyone willing to lace up and listen. The next story I'd like to read is from the ManilaStandard.net. Visually impaired athlete Nalmita claims gold in national para triathlon. Born without sight, Jerome could have been easily defined by limitation. Instead, he chose movement, challenge, and purpose. Alongside his twin brother, Joshua Nalmita, he discovered triathlon, not merely a sport, but as a powerful avenue for dignity, pride, and self-belief. Every race he enters is more than a competition. It is a statement. At the National Age Group Duathlon 2026 in Bakur, Jerome once again delivered a performance that echoed far beyond the finish line. Guided by Bernard Matthew Cruz, he conquered the demanding run-bike-run course with a time of 1 hour, 23 minutes, and 7 seconds, capturing the gold medal in the men's PTVI class. Yet what made the moment even more remarkable was not just behind the victory, but the mindset behind it. Jerome didn't celebrate as someone who had reached the peak. Instead, he spoke like someone still climbing. He openly acknowledged that the race revealed areas for growth, particularly in the running leg, his self-confessed weakest discipline. For many athletes, a gold medal signals arrival. For Jerome, it signals direction. It tells him where to push harder, where to improve, and where to evolve. That quiet hunger to get better even in victory is what separates good athletes from inspiring ones. The race carried an even deeper emotional weight. For the first time in a while, Jerome competed without his twin brother, Joshua, who was sidelined due to injury. The absence could have been avoided, but instead it became fuel. Because even when Joshua wasn't physically beside him, he remained present in spirit. Every stride, every pedal stroke, every breath carried the memory of shared struggles and victories. The bond between the twins, built not just on blood, but on perseverance, became Jerome's invisible guide alongside the one tethered to him. And perhaps that is the most powerful part of Jerome Nelmeda's story. He does not see the road ahead, but he moves forward anyway. He does not race alone, but he draws strength from both presence and absence. He does not settle for winning, but strives for growth. In a world that often measures ability by what is visible, Jerome reminds us that true strength lies in what cannot be seen, in discipline, courage, and an unyielding belief in possibility. His journey is not just about crossing finish lines. It is about proving, again and again, that the eyes do not define limits, but by will. That's the end of that story. The next story I'd like to read is from nowtolove.co.nz, entitled "Why Blind Marathon Runner Maria Williams Says She Wouldn't Change a Thing." Marathoner Maria lost her sight but found a new way to chase her dreams. Watching the sun set on a junk boat in Hong Kong, Maria Williams realized, with her congenital glaucoma rapidly worsening, it was probably the last sunset she'd ever see. There was a sadness, but also acceptance and a fierce determination to get on with her life. "It's a progressive condition," explains Maria. "I had heaps of surgeries and medication over the years, but I knew eventually my vision would fade away completely, and it did when I was in Hong Kong." Maria was 32 and remembers telling the friend she was staying with, who was also vision impaired, that she didn't want to make a fuss and they should continue with the holiday as planned. "We went to museums and climbed up Victoria Peak, went to Macau on a boat, shopped and went out for dinners. It was a little bit scary and a little bit sad," admits Maria, now 56. "But it was also a relief. I knew what I was left with, but I had to learn to live as a blind person and that I could only go up from there." An unexpected path into elite sport. Even so, Maria never imagined she would go on to become a world-class athlete, representing New Zealand in the paratriathlon and marathon. "It was really by chance I got into marathoning," laughs Maria, who was born with congenital glaucoma and as a child would do anything to avoid sport. A colleague at the time, Christine Adamson, said, "You've got the right build. You could be a good runner." I thought she'd forget, but she kept asking me about it, so I decided I'll have to show her that I'm not a good runner. Maria discovered she was a natural, and also that she loved it, and soon she was running half marathons. It's very freeing to be out moving on the streets and trails, smiles Maria, who runs tethered to a guide for safety. A mentor who changed everything. Next, Maria was introduced to two-time world marathon running champion Melissa Moon, who quickly became her guide, friend, and mentor. Melissa said, "I think you have what it takes to do a full marathon," and it seemed like an amazing goal to be able to run 42 kilometers. Training for the world stage. The pair trained together intensively and, in 2015, they qualified to run the full marathon at the Para-Athletic World Championships in London. It was an incredible feeling to be competing on the world stage, but the high was short-lived. Maria returned to New Zealand with persistent pain and was eventually diagnosed with stress fractures in her femur and foot. "It took a really long time to recover and build myself back up, but I knew I would do it," she says. A new discipline, a new challenge. That determination inspired her to take on a new challenge, the Paris Sprint Triathlon, which consists of a 750-meter swim, a 20-kilometer bike ride, and a 5-kilometer run. "It was fun to try a whole different learning curve," smiles Maria, who is tethered to a guide during the swim and run and rides a tandem bike. "The swim is my hardest challenge. You never know if the sea is going to be colder or rougher than expected. But I just have to get through it without panicking, keep calm, and push on." On the international stage, Maria and Melissa have competed together in New Zealand, Canada, Japan, and Australia. In 2023, she placed second at the World Paratriathlon Series in Devonport, Tasmania. But in recent years, self-funding international competitions, often with only 30 days' notice, started to take a toll. So now Maria focuses on events closer to home. She runs up to 16 kilometers twice a week with a friend, Kim Norton, and swims in the Wellington Harbor with another friend, Karen Jenkinson, up to 4 times a week. A circle of support. "I'm so lucky to have all these women around me helping me do these crazy things," tells Maria. She also works full-time for the Wellington Regional Council, walking to and from work daily with her trusted guide dog, Ava. "She's always with me and is a constant companion. Ava enables me to be more independent and confident," enthuses Maria, who rarely turns down the chance to try something new. "Saying yes to life. As I've gotten older, I've learned to just give things a go. I haven't planned a lot of what I've done, but when opportunity knocks, I open the door and say yes. People sometimes said, 'I feel sorry for you because I can't see,' but I don't think I'm disadvantaged at all. In fact, Maria's life is so full, she wouldn't change a thing. If I were offered to have my vision restored, I don't even know if I would accept, because I have just adapted to the way I am." The next article I'd like to read is from thestar.com.my, and the article is named Blind Athlete Takes It a Step Further with Race. Georgetown. Having conquered mountains in Nepal and completed a full marathon, visually impaired Darren Yoon now aims to complete a triathlon. The 48-year-old has been training for the Penang Chinese Swimming Club triathlon this coming Sunday, which comprises a grueling 800-meter swim, 20-kilometer cycle, and 8-kilometer run. I am preparing for my debut in triathlon in High Rocks, a fitness competition that blends endurance running with functional workouts. I hope this will inspire others in the disabled community to step out of their comfort zones, he said when interviewed by The Star. He added that everyone should strive to live the best life possible, regardless of the hurdles they face. To me, blindness is not a disability. It is just another challenge to conquer, Yuen said. The Penangite is legally blind to retinitis pigmentosa, a rare genetic disorder that causes the gradual breakdown of cells in the retina. The disorder is a progressive condition with no cure, though it can be slowed with assistive tools, emerging treatments such as gene therapy, retinal implants, and using protective UV-blocking sunglasses. Discovered in 2016, his condition gradually worsened over the years, leaving him with only blurred vision. I can only see blurry shapes now, he said. Yuen began his foray into endurance sports in 2016 with hikes up the Malu Pinnacles. In 2024, he trekked to the Mardi Himal viewpoint in Nepal, some 4,300 meters above sea level, raising over $21,000 for Nicholas's home for the blind. In March last year, he returned to Nepal's Annapurna Range and reached Annapurna Base Camp, located about 4,130 meters above sea level. His shift to road running has also drawn attention. In December, he completed his first full marathon during the Penang Bridge International Marathon, finishing in 5 hours and 49 minutes while tethered to a guide runner. The marathon was a huge milestone, but this April is about taking it a step further, he said. Despite the challenges of navigating a triathlon as a blind athlete, Yuen sees it as a technical task that can be overcome with preparation and trust. He has already competed an 800 swim and 5-kilometer run aquathlon at University Sains Malaysia in 2024. Beyond personal goals, Yuen has also been raising funds for specialized running shoes for visually impaired runners and their guides from the Ramkrishna Orphanage. As he prepares for Sunday's race, Yuen said he hopes to inspire others and highlight what is possible through determination. Your support means the world. Together, we can prove that when you refuse to let your circumstances define your limits, the horizon is endless, he said. And that'll do it for me on this week's edition of AJ Sports. I'll let Chris take it away.
Hello, listeners. It's Chris's time here. Today, we're talking football, soccer, rugby, all that good stuff and more to come. First up, Patrick Mahomes of Wheelchair Football leads Chiefs adaptive team toward dynasty. Chiefs, Bears to meet Saturday in Wheelchair Football Super Bowl in Kansas City. The Kansas City Chiefs aren't the only football dynasty in town. For the fourth time in the USA Wheelchair Football League's 4 years, the Kansas City Chiefs wheelchair football team reached the championship game, which takes place Saturday in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. The Chiefs wheelchair football team lost the inaugural Wheelchair Football Super Bowl 3 years ago, but won the title a year later in a rematch against the Los Angeles Rams wheelchair football team. Kansas City squad lost to the Cowboys wheelchair football team during last year's championship in Dallas, but the Chiefs hope they can cap a perfect season against the Chicago Bears wheelchair football team. Kickoff is set for 11 a.m. on Saturday at the Kansas City Convention Center. From everybody outside of Kansas City, it's pretty annoying that they can't find another city to be good at football, whether it's in a chair or out of a chair, quarterback Matt Bolig said. Bolig, a native of Chanute in southeast Kansas, was a junior quarterback at Ottawa University when he lost the use of his legs in a weightlifting accident. Now, though, he's known as the Patrick Mahomes of wheelchair football. "I think our team started it, to be honest with you," Bolig said with a smile. "I think the Chiefs, we started, and then it kind of took off with a hold on everybody else." But it's also fitting because the swagger Bolig plays with and the fact the Chiefs wheelchair football team never feels out of the game with him at QB. "The things that he does, I can't even begin to imagine, to describe," said Colton Kincaid, who was paralyzed below the waist in a heavy equipment accident 11 years ago. "He makes some plays sometimes that is the same thing as when you watch Mahomes on TV. You know, what are you doing? What are you doing? Don't do that. Then all of a sudden, it works, and you're like, okay, I can't even complain." Kincaid plays defensive back, wide receiver, and offensive line. He also serves as director of Chiefs wheelchair football team for Midwest Adaptive Sports. "We've been double digits before, and Matt's always the guy in the huddle to get everybody to calm down. We've got this. Let's play our game," Kincaid said. "The next thing you know, it's a tie game. We take the lead, and we pull out the win." After his injury, Kincaid gravitated to wheelchair basketball before discovering wheelchair football. It's very similar to wheelchair basketball in the aspect of how the chairs are played. The speed, the finesse aspect of it, but you get to add in a little bit more of the football aspect with the physicality. "We like to say rubbing is racing, so you're swapping out paint, you're out there grinding away, you're out there absolutely just hitting each other as hard as you can, putting guys on the ground. It really adds a whole new physicality aspect to the game." Kincaid relished in the chance to strap in and play football again. "It brought me back into team sports environment that, unfortunately, I wasn't able to play in prior to my injury due to concussions. It's a great feeling, a great environment to get to be back with my teammates." For Bolig, he's the only former college quarterback in the USA Wheelchair Football League, which is funded through a joint grant from the NFL's Salute to Service program and the Bob Woodruff Foundation. The Chiefs' wheelchair team is 9-0 this season, having won the two tournaments it entered to qualify for the championship game. Chicago won the other, and the fourth was canceled with a hurricane battering Tampa, Florida. Bolig, Kincaid, and company are eager to vie for a title in front of their hometown fans. "It's going to be amazing," Bolig said. "The crowd, I assume, being Chief fans, is going to be pretty loud." Kincaid added, "It brings a ton of motivation. We have all of our family, all of our friends, and all of our fans here supporting us in Kansas City." Next up, we're talking soccer. A disability is not inability. How this blind soccer league is changing lives in the world's newest country. South Sudan is not known for its soccer presence. The world's youngest nation is typically associated with basketball, with several current and former NBA players having roots in the country, and the Bright Stars international squad making its Olympic debut earlier this year. But one grassroots competition is beginning to make waves in the country with a different version of the beautiful game, and is shining a much-needed light on disabilities in the nation. South Sudan's Blind Premier League is backed by Light of the World, a non-governmental organization that works for disability rights and inclusion in South Sudan, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, and Uganda. It focuses on eye health and works with underserved communities, helping people with disabilities facing multiple barriers, such as children, women, rural communities, and those hit by disaster. The pioneering league began holding matches in 2023 and is currently made up of four teams, all based in the nation's capital city of Juba. The majority of the players are in their 20s, though the youngest player is 15. For those involved with the league, it provides an opportunity that many thought they would never have. Jimmy Just Augustine, who captains the competition's Cater Blind Football Club, had never even heard of blind soccer before he was introduced to it. Augustine went blind as a child in 2012. He experienced pain in both of his eyes, but was told by a village doctor that nothing was wrong. He eventually visited a doctor in Juba, but by that time, his retinas were damaged beyond repair. He was forced to give up soccer, but discovered the blind format in 2020. He has been nicknamed Messi after the Argentinian soccer legend by his teammates as a result of his dazzling dribbling ability. I am very happy with this experience because I never thought that I would play football again. I was thinking that I can never play any kind of sport again, he said, speaking to CNN Sport. With disability, you think, I'm nothing. I don't have something to do now. I'm useless. But currently, the activity is there. Your opportunity to dribble the ball is there. I've got new friends, and this experience that I've got from blind football makes me very happy. Away from the pitch, Augustine is a first-year student at the University of Juba and advocates for disability inclusion in schools. He told CNN about what it means to him to set an example for other people with disabilities in South Sudan. A disability is not an inability. If you're not seen, it's not that you are useless or not able to do something, he said, adding that he tells visually impaired people, if you want to change your life, come and join blind football. The rules of blind soccer. The rules of blind soccer differ significantly from its able-bodied counterpart. Each team is made up of 5 players, 4 outfield players, and a goalkeeper. The outfield players must be classified as completely blind, meaning they have very low visual acuity and or no light perception. But all of them must wear eye patching and eye shades, as some might see more light and shadows than others. The goalkeepers, meanwhile, are sighted and partially sighted and provide vital communication to their team in defense, though they must stay inside the small, restricted area around the goal. The ball has sonar rattles, making noise while it's on the move. Soccer games are notorious for their raucous crowds, but blind soccer spectators are required to remain silent during the game, so players are able to hear and locate the ball, which is a size 3 smaller than the standard size 5 ball used in an 11-side able-bodied game. Matches are 40 minutes long, played in 2 20-minute halves, and take place on a 40-meter by 20-meter, or roughly 131.2 feet by 65.6 feet, fields which have walls all the way around to prevent the ball from going out of play, allowing for a faster-paced game. Players must shout "Voy," or "I'm coming" in Spanish, in a nod to the game's Iberian roots, when making a tackle to warn opponents and minimize injuries. Each team also has another 2 guides to help them, one at the halfway line and another behind the goal the team is attacking. The International Blind Sports Association, IBSA, made blind soccer one of its official sports in 1996, and it has been a men's Paralympic game event ever since 2004. Host nation France made a history in 2024 Paralympics in Paris, winning its first gold medal in the sport by defeating Argentina on penalties in the final. Argentina ended the reign of Brazil in the semifinals, who had won gold at every games since the event was introduced. Finding the light. After decades of civil war, South Sudan gained independence from Sudan in 2011, following a referendum making it the world's newest widely recognized state. The nation descended into a civil war of its own shortly after, with the war officially ending in 2018, though violence persists to this day. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the conflict produced the largest refugee crisis in Africa. It ranks second to last, only ahead of Somalia, on the UN's Human Development Index. Nearly 2.4 million people had fled the country as refugees as of June 2023, while 2.3 million are classified as internally displaced within South Sudan. Among them is Simon Madol, who lives at the Mahad Camp for Internationally Displaced People, the IDP, in Juba. Madol said that soccer was his source of happiness and joy, but he was forced to abandon it when civil war broke out in 2013. He explained to CNN that he came across inclusive sports when approached by Light of the World at the IDP camp. He now serves as both a coach and technical director in the league and works for the Light of the World as a disability inclusion facilitator. According to Light of the World, it is estimated there are about 1.2 million people with disabilities in South Sudan. The country signed the UN's Disability Rights Convention last year in a historic step. Madol explained some of the challenges faced by disabled people in a nation facing so much internal struggle. The main challenge is the attitude of the people, a negative attitude, he said. Even in the family level, the community level, the level of negative attitude is always there, and this negative attitude leads to discrimination. Ignorance is at the root of the problem, according to Madol, and can dissuade people from getting involved in sports, such as blind soccer. There are also everyday issues experienced in the workplace. Most of the institutions are not accessible. You can find that you want to go to the office, but because the doors are narrow, there are steps, no ramps. It becomes hard for you to go, said Madol. Even in the schools, these things are also here. When it comes to blind soccer itself, the sport is not yet as accessible as it needs to be. Madol explained that specialized ball is not available to buy in the country. Groups such as Light of the World have to provide the equipment. Matches are scheduled to be played every weekend, though it can be expensive to hire the pitches. Despite some shortcomings, the competition has quickly had a positive impact, with Augustine saying that it has helped to raise awareness about disabilities and combat negative attitudes in the country. Madol says that it has been given its members a new direction of life. People are coming from far locations just to come and play the sport. Back in the day, they would only go from the house to school, from school to home, he said. But right now, there is another thing, blind football, where you find new people, new friends, communicate, make more connections, do other things outside, you support each other. Aiming high. Though the league is only a year old and still in a relatively nascent stage, it is focused on expansion. Madol told CNN that the aim is to involve teams from every state in South Sudan and has spent time in different parts of the country to assess how blind soccer can be brought to the area. The league has lofty and international aspirations. According to Madol, organizers are currently in the process of registering with the IBSA to create a path for South Sudan to compete at the Blind Football African Championships in 2026. Success at this tournament could potentially give the country a route into the World Blind Football Championships. And through the World Cup of Blind Football, who knows, maybe in 2028 at the upcoming Paralympics, we might participate, said Madol. And if we don't participate, we would have already prepared a way, and straight away, the next generation will pick up from there. He added that dream was no longer a suitable way to describe the league and players' targets, and that the word goal is the more appropriate term. It was a dream, but now it's becoming into a reality because we are working on it, he said. The goal is shared by players like Augustine. We want this football to not just be played here in South Sudan only, but in Africa, not only in Africa, but worldwide, he said. I want more players, more of these upcoming generations to come and join, because leaders come, leaders go. Today, we are the founders, and tomorrow, the next generation will come and take over from us. All right, now we're moving into the sport of wheelchair rugby. Wheelchair Rugby League is the newest battleground for sport between Australia and New Zealand. Brad Grove didn't compete at this year's Paralympics, and really there was never a possibility that he would. But that didn't stop many friends and family lamenting his absence. Grove is a veteran of the Wheelaroos, Australia's National Wheelchair Rugby League outfit. I was getting so many calls during the Paralympics, going, why aren't you over there? Don't you play in the Australian team? Grove said. Even on Facebook page, people were asking, where are the Wheelaroos? Didn't they qualify? Unlike wheelchair rugby, where the Australia Steelers won a bronze medal, wheelchair rugby league is not hosted in the Paralympics. Thanks to its hard hits and lightning speed, wheelchair rugby has exploded in popularity in recent years. But with its round ball and forward passes, it doesn't much resemble any of the other rugby codes. Wheelchair rugby league, on the other hand, certainly does. Played with a mixture of disabled and non-disabled players, tries are scored by grounding a size 4 rugby league ball in the opponent's goal area. Kicking and tackling is swapped for AFL-like handballing and tagging, and play is divided into 5 play sets. On the eve of a maiden 2-test series against New Zealand, at a home World Cup on the horizon, Wheelchair Rugby League has a major opportunity to allow the Australian public to familiarize themselves with the Wheelaroos. The most inclusive sport. Wheelchair Rugby League encourages participation from both disabled and non-disabled athletes. Out of the 5 players on the court, at any given time, 2 can be non-disabled. Bailey McKenna is one of the Wheelaroos non-disabled stars and said that it is what makes Wheelchair Rugby League the most inclusive sport. He took up the sport initially because he could play with his father, Darren, who was a key figure in the development of Wheelchair Rugby League in Queensland. My old man lost his leg in an accident when I was very young, and ever since then, we were looking for something that him and I could do together, McKenna said. I've been pretty much his right-hand man ever since the accident. McKenna burst onto the international scene at the 2022 World Cup in England, with numerous eye-catching tries, big hits, and player-of-the-match performances. The tournament was a watershed moment for Wheelchair Rugby League, with games being live-streamed and social media highlights amassing hundreds of thousands of views. But despite non-disabled players being an integral part of the sport, McKenna said he still received some flack online. I coped a lot of messages on Instagram and Facebook saying that I shouldn't be there. I'm not in a wheelchair. I don't have a disability. All of that sort of stuff, McKenna said. But one thing that people have got to remember is a wheelchair is actually a piece of hardware we use for the sport, like a tennis racket or a cricket bat. You've been listening to Audio Journal Sports Page, our effort to look at sports from a different point of view. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. This is Chris, along with Anna and Nick. If you have any information on any disabled sports and would like us to share it with our listeners, please give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.